Chris Berg is the CEO and head data chef at the Data Kitchen.
Demetrius, I'm not singing with you, all right?
He's got more than 25 years of
really
more than 30 and software engineering experience. Woo. At various points in his career, he's been a COO, a CTO, VP, and director of engineering. Yeah, woo, woo, woo. Chris Berg's gonna talk to us today about MLOps and the DataOps Manifesto. Welcome, everyone. We've got another meetup planned today with Christopher Berg, the CEO of Data Kitchen. And there's your intro.
All right. All right. Woohoo!
There we go. That's why people got to show up on time if they want the good intros.
Awesome.
There it is. Okay, so now that I've officially embarrassed myself.
No, hey, you were good. You were like towards the end. It was really, you were really in a groove.
I was jamming, man. Jamming there. So hold on. I got to get the camera all set up and everything again. Welcome, everyone that is with us. Hopefully you caught that intro. If you did not, we'll put it on YouTube for later. So now this is a few quick announcements for those that are just jumping in. If you're not in our MLOps community Slack, I encourage you to jump in it. I will leave a link to that in the chat or description if you're watching in the future. Also, I realize that people that are watching in the future, I know this doesn't apply to anyone that is with us today, but people that are watching in the future, YouTube told me that half of you are not subscribed. So subscribe and hit that like button so we can blow up and make this video go viral, especially the intro part there. And the last announcement that I will make before we jump into the conversation with Chris is that we are partnering, the MLOps community is partnering with the MLOps World Conference that is coming up in June. They've got some really cool stuff going on, and I would love for you to be a part of it. So again, I'm going to throw a link to that conference in the chat and or description, and I encourage you all to check it out. Join the conference. It's going to be really exciting, and there's all kinds of cool stuff going on. I may or may not play the guitar in that one too, to introduce a few people. I will be emceeing for a few of the talks, so you never know. I mean, the guitar is just right here, it's at arm's length, and if somebody says it, I don't need a lot of provoking, as you could tell earlier.
You should, Chris. Man, I think it would be awesome. Everyone deserves a guitar introduction once in their life.
That's it. Excellent. So now let's start this off. Chris, as I mentioned, you are CEO of Data Kitchen, and what you like to call the head chef. I know you all play with the kitchen metaphors quite a bit, and the chef, and you're the one in the kitchen cooking up the good stuff. I would love to know the journey to Data Kitchen. I know it's been around for a while. I also know that we have a pending conversation for another time about how you've bootstrapped your own MLOps company, but maybe you could tell us about this journey that you've taken. I mean, you have over 30 years of experience, you said. So give us the Cliff Notes version of that.
No, you don't want that. I could talk for an hour straight. You don't want my life story. I'm American, right? Grew up in the central part of the U.S., Wisconsin, working class kid, worked my way through college. After college, I taught in the Peace Corps in Africa for 2 years and went to graduate school and like fell in love with AI. And this was like 88 and 89. This was sort of deep in AI winter. It was like AI early January, and the winds were blowing and it was cold. And here's an example. My machine learning class had 6 people in. And if you go to like a machine learning class now, there's like 600 people in it. Like, everyone wants to take it. And so I was like super in love with AI. And I was like, this is awesome. And I wanted to work in it. And so I worked for 5 years at NASA to automate air traffic control, to like do intelligent sequencing and spacing advice for landing aircraft. And so like really cool. But I kind of fell in love, out of love with AI for a while, because it's like really hard to actually make it work. And like a lot of parameter tweaking. And I started to do software and startups, and one got acquired by Microsoft. And then, you know, I got married, had kids. And then about 2005, I thought, well, I'm a big software guy, right? I've done some AI, I've done some software. I'm going to do this data and analytics thing, and it'll be easy. Like, I'll be home by 5, no problem. And like, my life really sucked. Like, it was bad because like, yeah, I had really nice people working for me. You know, what we call now data engineers and data scientists, people who did viz. And we had thousands of people using our models and analytics. And like, man, my life sucked. People were calling me up saying, you're late, the data's wrong, the model's off, Chris. And I'd have to placate them and talk to them. And I just, you know, I'm an engineering nerd. I don't like conflict, right? And yeah. You get like a good-looking sales VP from one of the top pharma companies in the world saying, you delivered something wrong to my 5,000 sales reps. Ooh. It's not fun. Like, it's just like not a fun experience. And then, you know, I worked,
just to interrupt, was this you being like a consultant?
No, I worked at a company that did sort of data science and analytics for healthcare, and specifically pharma companies. And I was the COO. And so, I had people who were, you know, kind of doing the work, but I was kind of the guy who was going to make the trains run on time. Right. And I worked for a doctor who was, really smart guy, knew a lot about healthcare, but didn't sort of know a lot about the details of how things worked, the technical side. And he'd go off and say, okay, we're going to do this cool thing with data. And he'd bring it back to me. And I'd sit in a room with a couple people and we'd think of some things. And I'd go, hey, David, this is going to take us 2 weeks to do. And he'd look at me like I killed a patient on the table, going, Chris, I thought that should take 2 hours and not two weeks to do. I'm like, so my life just generally kind of sucked for years. Like things were breaking. We couldn't go fast enough. And we had hired a bunch of smart people and everyone liked their different tools. You know, we had the R people and the Python people and the Tableau people and the Click people and the visual data engineering people and the people like SQL. And so, you know, when we started the company sort of 8 years ago, I realized that problem is, the problem I had was sort of generalizable to everyone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess I'm getting up there in years and I wanted to like remove the amount of pain that others people have, because I do think when you get involved in the day-to-day work and sort of wresting insight out of data, that you end up with these kind of problems of you run a factory and how do you do that? And you're also kind of a software team and how do you deal with that? And you've got all these great new tools coming out and really interested in data. And so how do you innovate? And so that was really the genesis. And in the journey, like we're still profitable. We're still group bootstrapping. We've been growing 30 to 50% a year. And like 5, 6 years ago, no one really knew what we talked about. And like we tried to call it DevOps for data science for a while. We tried to call it Agile Analytic Operations. That didn't stick at all. And then we tried to call it Analytic Ops. But then if you short it down, it's not a good sounding word at all. And so we settled on calling it Data Ops. But like now there's Model Ops and ML Ops and, you know, Ops everywhere. And there's like a lot of, it's actually really nice to see, the journey from like people not knowing what we're talking about to having meetups and communities and conferences. Cause I think people have realized that you've got to sort of build a system in order to do innovative work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the model or the data transformation is really the cool part. And in order to get that done, you sort of got to build the factory around it. And that's sort of what I'm interested in.
So I look at data ops and that term as something that is its own thing, it's its own discipline, and it doesn't necessarily encompass ML ops, but ML ops does encompass data ops. Would you agree with that statement?
You know, I don't really honestly care what ops term you use, right? Because call it, you know, your favorite ops. Because like the terms are so, first of all, as an engineer, like I want precise definitions. But like I run a company in marketing and you want your term to be known. And so I look at it from like a completely oddball way. So you could call it whatever ops term you want. But in general, the way I touch the elephant is there's a team of people who are working on a shared technical thing, right? And that, and how you run that team and how you manage that team for success and how you build a system for them to work in is really important. And so I think people have figured this out, and not just in building data science models. They've figured it out in building software. And 50, 60 years ago, they figured it out in building cars. And so those same set of principles on how you run a team who are all sharing this thing, you know, I think this shared technically complicated thing, I think generally they flow through DevOps and Agile and Model Ops and Data Ops and Lean Manufacturing and the Toyota Production System. They're all kind of the same sort of conceptual ideas, because one of the most important things is because everyone's working on a shared technically complicated thing. First of all, honesty is really important. Right. And then second of all, the system at which you work in is an artifact that you need to manage. And so for cars, it's the assembly line. You know, for software, it's the infrastructure as code and your CI and CD pipeline and testing. Mm-hmm. And for data ops, model ops, ML ops, it's a system that helps you deploy, helps you monitor, helps you test, helps you manage environments that you work in.
So yeah, let's dive into that a little bit, or let's like zoom in, I should say, because there is a trend that I have seen, and I was just talking to somebody about this earlier today, in the different companies that you see that are doing ML ops, and the marketing side of things is saying that we have the best practices baked in to our solutions. So you don't have to know these best practices, or you won't get caught with your pants down. Now, I always wonder, and I really like ponder, what are these best practices that these companies are talking about? And so maybe you have a few that you've baked into your solution that you can talk about. I mean, because there's this one part of me that says, oh, well, that's just marketing. And then there's another part of me that says, well, actually, version control is the best practice. And so if you have that baked into a solution, or like being able to collaborate easily is a really nice, is it a feature or best practice? I don't know, but it is something that you need. And there are, if you look at the old, well, not old, but if you look at software development, there are best practices that have arisen.
Yeah.
And so we're still in that phase, I think, right now, where I still haven't figured out what are the best practices for ML ops, and then how do they get baked into tools?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess one of the things I sort of think about is I separate, you know, there's marketing and what it really does. And then there's the tool that you use to create your model or your insight, right? That, and what, at the end of the day, what is that? That's some code and some parameters, right? That, and so you're right. That number one best practice is stick it in Git. And version it, right? A number two best practice is when that code runs in production, right? Monitor it and check to see if it's right. Observe it, you know, monitor it, because hey, the model could go out of tune. The data going into it could be wrong. The data transformation could break. Like, you know, shit happens. And you don't trust your data providers. Right. That's number two. And then number three, like when you're in development with it, when you're playing around with it, you also need to test it. Right. You need to check to see if it's accurate. You need to check to see if if someone else has developed some data that's feeding into it, have they broken it? So you need to regression and functional test it. So source code, make sure you test in development, but test the whole thing, the whole system. And then in production, monitor it and check it's right. That makes sense. And then the third part, which is comes from software, is that that little basket of code that you've written in parameters that runs in some engine, Python, you know, whatever, you know, Python or some AutoML tool or SAS, that has to fit into some a piece of hardware infrastructure, right? Infrastructure as code. And that should be, you should, that in of itself should be scriptable and testable and deployable. So, and so if you follow those principles of and then the third principle or the fifth principle, I would think, is if you're doing something by clicking buttons, automate it, write a script. The movement of work from dev to production, the checking of something and testing should be all automated. You should script up your infrastructure and not press buttons. And like everything should be kind of driven off of scripts as opposed to you doing anything manually. And so the stance that you want, like psychologically, I think, is whatever you do with data, you want to put it into production and you want to sit back and have it tell you if it's working right and tell you if it's working wrong. So number one, you don't get yelled at. So you don't have that good looking VP of sales from a pharma company call you up and yell at you. Like, you just don't want to do that. Like, it's bad, right? And okay. The other part is just don't trust anybody. Don't trust your data providers. Don't trust your, you got to check stuff. And you know, it's work, but it's worth it, because one of the challenges that a lot of teams have is they just end up kind of focusing on their world. They're like, oh, I did the data transformation, or I did the model, or I did the visualization. My part's good, you know? And so there's a stance that you own the result and not just your piece, right? Yes. You get to focus on the value you're delivering to a customer, the whole part and parcel of the pieces, and not just like, hey, I did the model, I'm done. You know, it's someone else's fault if it breaks, which is very tempting to do. But that's, so those principles of source code, testing, infrastructure as code, automation, owning the result, I think are what you need to do. And it doesn't really, honestly, it doesn't have a lot to do with if the model is in Python or in R, if it's a TensorFlow model, if it runs in Data IQ or runs in Data Robot. The engines that run the model and the tool that you use to develop the model, you know, those, to me, those vary. And like people like their tools, and like, I just never want to go through R versus Python, or like, you like this IDE versus another IDE. It's just not important in my mind. The system that you work in, the factory, is more important than the individual workstation that someone works at.
Yes. That is so important to remember and keep in mind. And there are two things that you said there that I just want to reiterate, because I find them so insightful. One is, don't trust anyone. Don't trust your data providers, especially. And we may have to make that as a quote for you. And the other one is the idea of owning the outcome, owning the whole thing, not just this small piece. And I've heard it time and time again. Somebody else put it, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, they were putting it as like, the sum is greater than the parts, right? Or whatever that saying is. Is
the
that
sum
saying?
Is greater than the whole. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Or whatever. You know what I'm saying. But that is the idea here, is really looking at zooming out and not focusing just on this little piece and then forgetting about it and giving up ownership. And I know that we've had great questions in here about how to do that and how we can get data scientists more involved in the whole process as opposed to just their specific piece. And someone I remember mentioned, should we put them on rotations or like on-call handoffs? And I think the answer was yes, that one speaker talked about. But this is, for me, this is really an interesting piece. And it comes back to, these are more cultural aspects, or these are bigger pieces than just like what you were talking about. It's not like if you're running Python or R, you're looking at something that's bigger than that and making sure that it runs no matter what and making sure that it works.
Yeah, and tells you if it doesn't, and making sure that you, and like a couple things you said, that sort of, some people call it project a product. Some people call it customer value focus as opposed to the task focus, and, you know, being results oriented instead of process oriented. There's lots of different terms, right? But it is actually harder to focus on the results than just on your piece of the task.
Yeah.
And it's because you run the risk of your customer saying, it doesn't work, or it isn't one I wanted. And then you can, it's hard, right? It's hard to hear negative feedback. And like the idea here is, can you push the negative feedback forward and quicker and find out if things aren't working faster? Because that way you don't spend so much time on doing the wrong thing.
Yes.
And the real idea here is that, you know, we all are introverted. Well, maybe you, because you play music, you're not introverted. But me, the thought of like spending a month in front of a screen building something, like I'd actually like to do that. I talk to people too much now. And like I spent, you know, most of my career has been long periods of thought in front of a screen. Mm-hmm. And like, I like it, you know, it's fun. And the thought like, oh, I could think of something and then I have to talk to someone in 6 weeks when I'm done. That's really cool, right? I can build my crystal castle and it's really neat. And I think about code and models when I sleep and I wake up. And the problem is that 6 weeks later, you may have thought, okay, I had to do these 10 things. And in that 6 weeks, you do those 10 things. And then when you finally get feedback from the customer, they say, yeah, great. You know what? I only wanted these 5 things and I don't want the other 5. And here's 2 more that you didn't think of.
Yeah.
And so you ended up wasting your time, right? You wasted basically half your time because you got it wrong. And so there's a humility that needs to be, and like, you just don't know what the world wants. And if you can deliver real value quicker, you can learn more. And iteration cycle time increases the amount of learning that you do. And if you're humble about what you know, and you're cognizant of your own psychological tendencies to want to sort of build crystal castles, if you can find ways to deliver kind of little smaller chunks. And so maybe the best model in the world isn't what you need to do. Maybe get a crappy model, a crappy regression that you spent 4 hours doing, but getting it in front of a customer quicker may be better than 6 weeks of building, you know, the best ensemble model you've ever heard. Mm-hmm. And that's hard for people because like, it's more fun to like spend 6 weeks playing around with data. But it's really is, I think that's the value focus is not just focus on customer value, but focus on rapid feedback of customer value. And that's, it's hard to do, but it really actually makes you, it makes you much more effective, and you end up getting much more done, in the world and having much more of an effect on the world.
So there's, I want to get into data ops, but I also want to be cognizant of what you're saying. And I really wanted to dive in on a few of those that you were talking about. Maybe last thing before we jump into data ops, and really it's, again, what you're talking about is so much of this, these DevOps principles, this agile that can be generalized enough to, it's useful for ML ops or data ops or whatever ops you're calling it, as you mentioned. And I'm wondering, because this is something that we've heard so much of, just get something working end to end and then build on top of it. But make sure that you can get something working and it is actually solving the solution of the problem that you're setting out to solve, not like getting caught up and then you go on some tangent. And Charles Martin, who was on here, like one of the first guests on here, he talked about the quote from, I think it was Vapnik, who said like, one does not impose, oh man, I don't know if I can even remember this quote, but it's something along the lines of, you don't solve a problem by posing a harder problem in between it and then having to solve that problem, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
That's a horrible, I'll figure out the real quote and then put it in the chat or something later. But that's the idea, that sometimes when you're sitting in these 6 weeks and you think, well, you know, I'm going to get to X, and then you reach a certain point and you go, well, actually, what about if I create this or that? And then it gets a little bit hairy and you lose track. But yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, this stuff is like, I started my career in 1991 working at NASA Ames, and my branch chief would say, build a little, test a little, learn a lot. And he was like, I was just like, oh, he's like my age. He's like an old guy at the time. And I was like, oh, that's just engineering wisdom. And he set it up so like every week we'd have a simulation run, and we invited in, we had paid what we called pseudo pilots and paid air traffic controllers come in. And every week we tweak our algorithms and they go, this is wrong, this is right. And then we go off and fix it. And actually that was like a super fun way to work. Cause like every week we'd find out how wrong we were.
Yeah.
Right. Or how right we were. And we try something new. And like that sort of cycle of rapid feedback is just, you grow and learn so much. And it's harder, but after a while, I really, really like that. And I think any good engineering wisdom is true no matter what language you put it in. And the Agile Manifesto was written in 10 years later in 2001, right? DevOps started 2009, right? And so this is just good common sense, like build a little, test a little, learn a lot.
Yeah.
That's like, that makes total sense to me.
Yes.
And that's all we're really saying. And I'm just, the tweak that's onto it is build from a manager's perspective. You have to build a system that enables your people to do that and not kill themselves and not create a lot of debt and technical debt and crap that they got to fix up later. So it's not, it's not quite as easy as like, throw some stuff up and see what sticks. It's like, you got to continually build a system that would enable you to do that.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about data ops and let's get into it. I know you wrote the Data Ops Manifesto, and I've also heard, this was one that a friend of mine wanted me to ask you. They were saying, some say that data ops is data management reborn. Do you have thoughts on that?
I certainly think the word, like ML ops, people who, the ops term is ending up encompassing the work that you do in addition to the system that you build to do the work. And so that happened in software with DevOps. I don't know why an IDE is a DevOps tool in my mind, because it's just an IDE, but they call it that, right? And so the word inflation is happening in tech all the time. And so some companies have taken their 10-year-old change data capture tool or their ETL tool and called it data ops. And I don't think that that's true, no more than a Jupyter notebook is a model ops tool, right? So, but that's what companies do, right? And so like companies from a marketing perspective want to grab on a term, and we did it too, right? We want to be known as data ops. We wrote the manifesto, number one, because after going to a conference, no one knew what the hell we were talking about. And we were trying, like we debated, should it be model ops? Should it be ML ops? Should it be? And so like, we had to pick something. So we picked data ops.
Yeah.
And ironically, it's actually even a bad name because it's not even about data. It's actually about the code that acts upon the data. And so I'm a little, run a company, so I have to market, and, we've chosen data ops as our term. And it's fine. And that's why we wrote the manifesto and wrote a book. But from my standpoint, I just want people to give some attention to it and think it's worthy of not just data ops, but any of these testing, deployment automation, monitoring, observations in production. Just give it some love, because if you do, your life's going to be better. And you're not going to there's still a lot of companies I talk with where people are frustrated, where they got their master's in data science and they can't get any models into production. They've been working in the field for a while and it takes them, you know, 6 weeks to get anything done. And what happens is organizations will build, get hit with the reality of crappy data, demanding customers, and lack of attention, and building these fragile, brittle systems. And after a few months, that creates this logjam of meetings and tasks and process, and everything slows down.
Yeah.
And that just ends up being like a totally not fun environment to work in. And so I find people are very frustrated, right? Because they get caught in sort of fear mode.
Well, one thing that has come up, and there's some great people in the community that are talking about this, and I would love to hear your opinion on the standardization that needs to happen. And right now, there's a great way that someone put it, is that the standardization is trying to happen inside of companies, as opposed to like, oh, this is going to be the one standardization to rule them all. And then you just get more standardization on top of standardization. And everyone thinks their one way of standardizing the whole market is going to flood to. But what I feel like I've seen is so many different companies are trying to standardize within their company, but they're having trouble doing that. Do you feel like that is a correct reflection of what you've seen?
And what do you mean by standardizing? Like standardizing on a tool, or what do you mean?
I mean, no, like more the way that you're doing things inside of that. And it can be fairly low level, or it can be higher, like just the processes and the way that you go about like what you're doing with those processes, or like the actual technology side of saying, hey, we're going to use this, whatever it is, like this is our API way of defining things, or like the tech that's involved in it.
Yeah. I look at it like a different angle. Like I think that there's a lack of perception of the need to spend time on doing the operations part of the equation, on building the factory as opposed to building the car that comes out of the factory. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, I don't particularly, like, there's a lot of talk about what is the latest cool model and the latest prediction, and that's fantastic, really cool stuff. But you got to devote, think of it, 15% of your time on building the factory. And what is in there? Testing, monitoring, deployment automation, environment management, building a nice little system that you can drop your code into, and it'll tell you it's working right and it hasn't broken anything. And when it's running in production, it'll tell you that, hey, it's you know, you haven't been screwed by your data providers or your model's not out of whack. And like that takes time and effort to build that. And it's not the cool stuff that you get from the media and like, oh, I want to use the new TensorFlow processing unit from Google. That's super cool. I saw the rack and the Google I/O, like, oh man, it's exabytes and flops. It's like that's the cool stuff. And I'm like, I don't deny that that's cool, right? I just say that the real work is you got to devote 15% of your time on doing the factory stuff. And that, if you put some time into it, you're going to be better off. And to me, that's what I want people to standardize on. And I don't care what word you use. I just wanted to get some attention and love, because if you don't, you end up in the world of hurt I was in 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I just want people to get out of that world of hurt.
Well, so I'm thinking also like people that want to use tools as these Lego blocks. And right now it feels like there is enough non-standardization that they can't easily plug into each other, right? Do you feel the same way on that?
To a certain extent, I would agree. Yeah, I think the there's lack of a standard, like another bit of engineering wisdom I learned at NASA was good interfaces make good neighbors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a very complex ecosystem of tools and servers in the data and analytic value chain. Like if you walk the journey from where it comes from, a transactional system goes through streaming, buckets, data lake, data warehouse, model, visualization, governance. That could be a half a dozen tools that run on a half a dozen different servers. Mm-hmm. And so at any point along the line, you want to change one of those things, you could mess things downstream up. And so defining your interfaces and thinking in a systematic way is good. And I'm not sure, I'm less of a believer in the fact that you could abstract all that away into one giant mega abstraction of like, here's the Uber abstraction that sits across data transformation and visualization and model. Like there has been standards of PMML. There was this one out of the University of Chicago that was like called TFA. It was another abstraction of the model. And I tried to build one back in the late 2000s. And like, I'm not a big believer in abstracting it. I really think these are code-driven systems and you got to sort of apply some good engineering principles. And like, it's complicated and software engineering is so you got to think in complexity, how to break things into components, how to have good interfaces. And, you know, standards can help, but they're not the panacea.
Yeah. So talking about the data ops manifesto and almost going back to what we were talking about in the beginning on if you got to own the results. And I've heard it put another way of like, if you build it, you build it, you ship it, you own it kind of thing.
Yeah. And
I'm wondering, like, it's got to be everyone's responsibility from the data engineer to the data scientist. How have you seen that cohesion and those two teams and the greater teams, the machine learning engineers, working well together? Is there anything along these cultural side of things, like what has worked when you see those different people and teams working?
Yeah, not more meetings. Like I just, you know, let's not sing kumbaya and hold hands and have more meetings and stand ups. Like, you know, I think you need to have a shared abstraction between all those people that they can understand in a technical way their relationship to each other. And so, because it's not just data engineers and ML ops engineers and data scientists, and it's also people who do visualization and governance, right? And it's people who do IT, who provide raw data. Mm-hmm. Like if it's a value chain, it's a series of steps. And if you don't have that shared abstraction, then you're just going to have more meetings. And so, you know, there's this other phrase that people use. It's called pull the pain forward. And so what that means is I'm going to change a piece of that system. How can I then tell at my desktop by myself without any meetings what the ripple of that effect is? And that's super important, because if you don't do that, then you're really tempted to put your blinders on. I change my piece. Okay, let's have a meeting. Let's have a checklist, you know, and then like, if you're any good, technically, then you get pulled into more meetings because you're the person who has the whole system in their head. And then you're like, your whole life's full of meetings and you're not doing anything fun. And so devote 15% of your time to building that, building something, that shared abstraction that everyone can see the end-to-end system in. And I think that is a way to help teams get away from, because I mean, communication's fine, right? I mean, I'm not against people talking to each other. I'm just saying it's much easier to build an artifact that represents the factory, the flow of the value chain of data, and give people visibility into it than just have more meetings.
So if I understand this correctly, it's something that you would have each person having their own understanding of what they're doing, what their responsibilities are, but how it affects each other person in the value chain.
Yeah, exactly. So like, let's say I'm a data engineer and my data is going into a feature that's in a model. And my data is also going into a dashboard that someone looks at. And lo and behold, I want to change something. I get a new request. Mm-hmm. So I change it. Now, one option is I change it. I do my work. And then a week later, I have a meeting with the data scientist and the people who do data visualization. And they say, what the F? You broke everything. that's a form of collaboration, right? I just think, why not pull the pain forward and have that data engineer at their desktop make that change and then run some tests against the model, run some tests against the viz, and see if it's right. And you know what? That's the same. You tilt it a different way in software. It's the same idea of sort of back-end, front-end engineers. Because right now, a back-end engineer changes a REST API on an application. They can run a test and see the effect of that in the UI. And so the pain's pulled forward for them. And then they're like, oh man, I shouldn't go change in the REST API because like I just broke all my UI. Yeah. And so is that a standard? Well, yeah, the REST API is a standard, but like, you know, but is it the semantics of the REST differs on every application? It's really, I've built a system that allows me as an individual to get that, see a local change and judge its global effects.
Yes.
And so I want the same thing in data and analytics. I change it because the models go anywhere along the line. They go before the data, after the data, and like anywhere along the line, you can make a change and something would break. And even like the poor neighbor of data governance, right? You're trying to keep track of what data is there or what happens there, that, you know, that should be you should be able to do that as code as well. And so that's all I want is like, man, just pull the pain forward so you see your effect. And like, life is so much better, honestly, if you do that. Because the other part is when you have a system like that, you as an individual contributor become replaceable. And you know what? You want yourself to be replaceable because that means you can move on to different things. And so a good way to judge a highly functioning data and analytic team is, can you have a 22-year-old recent CS graduate tweak a model and deploy it into production in a day or a week without and having a really, really high probability that it's all going to work? And so, like, I don't know, there's not a lot of organizations that are like that.
I was just going to say, you've seen those organizations?
Yeah, but you know what? In software engineering, the leadership says, this is a goal for my company. I want to hire someone, have them fix a bug and get it into production their first week of work. They measure themselves on that because they've built a system. They've devoted not 15% of their engineering effort, 25, 30% of their engineering effort is building that system. That's called the DevOps engineer. Those people are paid well. And so MLOps engineers, DataOps engineers, whatever the hell you can call them, right? I don't care. Like, put some time on it because, man, it matters. And if you do that, your life is going to be better. You're not going to be stuck owning the model or the data work you did 3 years ago and having to fix it. You're not going to be like doing something and then you throw it over the wall to someone else and you're onto something new. And then you got a context switch 2 weeks later when it finally gets into QA. And like, there's a lot of things about just your enjoyment personally of work, mm-hmm. because you're more in the flow of being able to work and get things done and not being stuck owning stuff that you built 2 years ago. And I don't know, I find there's a lot of, the average time of a CDO is like 2.5 years. I find a lot of young data engineers and data scientists are not happy with their jobs because they're feeling like they don't have any effect.
Yeah. Yeah. We've seen that quite a bit too. And you see all kinds of blog articles about it. Now let's talk about this testing that you were talking about, because I know that one of the co-hosts for the podcast that we do was just talking to me a week or two ago about how to better create tests in the MLOps environment. And you mentioned that, like, being able to see the ripple effects. How have you seen that done? And how have you seen it done well?
Well, first of all, I don't think you should, those tests are some code artifact. They're automatically written, right? And I'm more of a fan of the sort of functional programming model, right? Where in a functional programming model, you think of everything like a big tube. You pour something in, it runs, you get the same result every time. You know, the function machine from like third grade. And if you do that in data and analytics, what happens is you can just pour the same data in and you should be able to get the same result. And well, what if you change the code that's in the middle of that tube that you're pouring data in? Well, you should get nearly the same result or something close to it. And so what I find is like the one is automate the tests, that's code. Number two is probably better if you can to work in a more functional way, right? Where you sort of take data, pour it in, and then run the tests all the way around the value chain and then have a big red, green light saying, hey, it works in development, or hey, something's weird. And there's a lot of techniques to testing and, you know, from simple line counts, row counts to statistical controls to, and there's a whole art to testing because you can't test everything. But think of the amount of work you do as a data engineer, data scientist. Think of at least 10% of your time you should be writing some automated tests. And then so functional programming, test everywhere, 10% of your time writing automated tests. But the other trick is, lo and behold, those tests themselves can be run in production. And they can, you know, maybe not all of them, but the difference between a test in development and a monitor in production is kind of small in my mind. Wow. Because like, you know, if you're running the system, it should work. And so you can then, that's a reason why you ought not sort of double duty. A lot of the tests in development can be run in production. And the real difference is in production, your data is varying, but your code is fixed. In development, your data is fixed, but your code is varying. But between those, the tests are fixed.
Yes.
I'm more of a fan of like thinking in these functional systems because it makes your life easier. Because there's a lot of like state management in a lot of these systems and like intermediate development QA databases where you got to patch and like it's just start over again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the cloud, you know, retrain your model from the beginning, rerun your system. It's pennies to do that.
So you're giving me a lot of great quotes here for later. I appreciate that. I'm wondering how you feel considering Google just has been announcing all of their fun stuff. And I know you mentioned that you watched it. There is this common debate that we get in the community about one tool to rule them all or the best of breed pieces. And it feels like Google just made their statement on, we're going to have the one tool to rule them all. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I've been hearing the same damn thing for 20 years, right? The one tool. And like, first of all, it was like, everything's going to be in the Oracle database and there's Oracle cartridges and Java plugins and like, you know, and then it was going to be the Hadoop and uh-huh. Spark and everything's going to be in there. I think the cloud vendors are really trying to have every tool that you need to do data science and engineering, just like they're having every tool that you need to do software engineering. And you know what? Some of their tools are good and some of them aren't. And maybe at some point in the future, there'll be that everything you'll need in the cloud vendor. But right now, it's there's pockets of good things and pockets of challenging things. And most people I deal with have a whole host of different tools. And they have legacy that they're never going to want to convert. And so a widely divergent tool chain is the norm. And maybe at some point, there'll be one tool to rule them all. But like it hasn't happened in software. I mean, there's not like, hey, what's the one tool that, well, people keep creating and inventing and the level goes up. So yeah, I'm a little cynical on it just because number one, I heard it before. And number two, man, people keep inventing and creating, and like, it just doesn't go away. And so, and number three, in legacy happens, if you're going to live in the real world and not start greenfield projects, you're going to have old stuff and new stuff. And there's so many companies that they're like, you can see the turds of one tool to rule them all living, like they've got a Teradata, and then they've got a Hadoop cluster, and then they've got Spark. And like everyone was telling them that it was going to be one thing to rule them all. And like, yeah. Okay, now they got three things. and then they're moving to the cloud. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, I would say, I hope it's not one tool to rule them all. I've said this before. It seems like a pretty bleak future where we just use the cloud providers and everything that they have, their whole suite, and then they monopolized it. Essentially, there's the three that you have as the triopoly or whatever you call it. And I'm a fan of the little guys. So hopefully it's not like that. And these arguments that you're saying, it does seem like, yeah, it's not going to happen. They're going to try as hard as they can. But like you said, there's pockets of good and there's pockets of bad. And people have been trying for years
and haven't done it. And so, because I also think the other part is there's a lot of people who want to, there's sort of some resume stuffing that happens for people. Uh-huh. They're like, I read the article, this is the new thing, and I need to have some experience on it. And like, you know, I find the people who've got a 20 terabyte database in Spark, like I laugh because it's like, you don't need 20 terabytes in Spark. You know, I can put that like on my zip drive. Yeah. Like, and so there's people are trying to, or, you know, I'm doing a complicated ensemble model and I should just be doing a regression, right? There's people want to get resume stacking as opposed to focus on what's the fastest and most, the least increment of work I can do to get some value to the customer and then improve. And I think it's not good because it actually doesn't, I don't know, maybe it helps people get jobs, but like, I don't know, maybe this has to do a lot with employers who are kind of doing resume filters and searching. Cause I mean, you know, at some point, just because you happen to have experience in X tool doesn't mean that you're any good at it.
Well, actually, I will say that we had Flavio on here a while ago too, almost a year ago, and he mentioned that one of the biggest mess ups in his company with machine learning was because somebody was trying to do that resume driven development. And so they said, let's try this new tool, which just went all haywire. And he was the only one that actually knew how to do that. So then when he wasn't on call and things went wrong, you got into a big, big problem. And I remember he said that it was like a recommender system that recommended the same thing to every single person that visited the website for 18 days straight. And so he was like, you can imagine how much money that lost. And I tell this story again and again, because it is the perfect example of that. It is, you know, these models gone rogue, or the example of the resume driven development that it doesn't need to happen. And so last question for you before I let you run. And I want to thank you again for coming on here and opening my mind. You've given so many great quotes, whether it's your own or your NASA mentors that used to tell you these things. If we are in these legacy systems, we're at an enterprise and we're fighting through the legacy swamp, how do I get started with MLOps?
I think the two things I tell people are, number one is to, every time you have a problem, big or small, write it down. And then once a month, sit down with some people and look at the list and prioritize one thing that you're going to fix. And when you fix it, do it in an automated script-driven way so it doesn't happen again. And then the second thing, this is started with ops, is write some tests and have those tests, run them in your development cycle every time, and then run them in production. And you don't need any tool to do that. And but that's on the line that you want to give 15% of your time to these ops type activities. And a quality circle where you review problems and then fix them, you write some automated tests, it's on that line. Because the real challenge is most people are spending 1% of their time on this stuff and 99% of their time on, you know, pulling what they feel is the heavy backpack full of tasks out. I got to get my model going, I gotta get my data going.
Yeah.
And they're very burdened with that backpack because it's full of requests from their customers. And they don't feel right about doing these things. And so if you just start doing it, one very baby step or two, you're going to see the effects and you're going to start saying, oh, wow, I should do this more.
Yeah, it comes back to the idea of being reactive or proactive. And if you dedicate this 15% of your time, I really like that idea, like dedicate 15% of your time to these ops tasks. And you'll be in a position where you can be proactive as opposed to reactive when things are just happening. And like you said, you're trying to lift the heavyweights, but you're encountering roadblocks along the way.
Yeah. And you know, you don't have to end up being a gray-haired old fart like me who's telling stories about working the weekend and leaving the kids' soccer match. It's like, you know, it's not, there's a lot of, if you start, once you get in the field, you're going to start to have that. And it's not, you're not successful when you're working nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. You know, you just haven't done the work to build a system to do that. And, you know, yeah, there's some time, like hope and heroism should only happen a little bit. And if you're a hero all the time, if you're hoping stuff can work. So like, I mean, I think that's really, that's what it comes down to is you're on the road to get burnt out.
Yeah. It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been enlightening, to say the least.
And that was the best intro ever, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yes. Anytime. It was my pleasure. And I really appreciate you coming on here, sharing your wisdom with us. You've been through a lot. And so hopefully we don't have to go through most
that's
of it.
Good, man. That's the idea. Yeah. That's it. And so, and then when all you young guys get my age, you'll realize that there's something else systematically wrong and you'll fix it. And so that's what it's all about.
Yes, exactly. So thanks again, Chris, and everybody out there listening. I appreciate you sticking around. Go check out what Chris is doing if you liked it. And best way to reach out to you, Chris, if they want to continue the conversation?
Just datakitchen.io. Just come to our website and you can get me there.
There we go. All right. See you later.
Thank you. Bye.